Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When is a share of stock not really a share of stock? Type stock split into Google today. That'll give you some idea. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 13th of April. Good to have you here. The money factory that is Google reported earnings late yesterday, almost $2.9 billion in profits. Come on, admit it. You'd love to get a piece of that action, right? Own shares of a company whose stock price closed somewhere north of $620 in New York today? Truth is, that's a tad rich for many investors' blood, which is one reason Google is going to split its stock this summer in a two-for-one deal. The share price will come down, but Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports that's not why Google management, also known as the founders, decided to do it.
Google's new shares would be known as Class C shares. People who own Google stock would get one additional Class C share for every Class A share they own. But the shares are not created equal. James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
The new shares don't have any voting rights. You're concentrating the voting power even more in the hands of the founders.
Right now, three people at Google control 70% of the company's voting power. Founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page, and Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt. They own special shares that have 10 times the voting rights of everybody else's. Still, Google has been hiring thousands of people each year, and they've been getting voting shares. Investors have been buying them, and all those votes start to add up. Danny Sullivan is editor-in-chief of Search Engine Land.
If anybody had bought Google stock and didn't realize that these founders want to do whatever they want with their company, they got a wake-up call.
Welcome to Silicon Valley, says tech analyst Tim Beharin.
These type of entrepreneurs who have watched their companies grow from zero to these massive forces feel that they have the best understanding of how to drive the company forward.
Beharin says we may see the same thing when Facebook goes public later this year. Founder Mark Zuckerberg is expected to remain all-powerful. Google will vote on the measure at a shareholder meeting in June, though it's probably safe to say it's in the bag. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Picked up my taxes from my accountant this morning. Checked that little box that says, yes, I want $3 to go to the presidential election campaign fund, even though I know it's not going to lower my taxes at all. But here's the thing. Ain't nobody going to use that money this time around. Every candidate from Watergate up to, but not including Senator Obama in 2008, did take matching funds. But now nobody wants the limits on spending that come with doing that. Don't you wonder, though, what a 2012 campaign with public funding might look like? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
If the presidential candidates took the public campaign money, they would each get about $90 million from Uncle Sam. That's all they could spend. Bob Bierzak is a senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics.
$90 million now works out to be something like $10 million a week. That's a fair amount of money.
Still, compared to the nearly $750 million President Obama raised in 2008, that's chump change. So our publicly financed candidates would ask their respective parties to take over polling and get out the vote work. As for campaign advertising...
Enter the super PACs.
That's NYU Public Service Professor Paul Light. He says, ironically, candidates taking public money would rely more than ever on super PACs, which can raise and spend unlimited money. Presidential candidates can't coordinate with their super PAC backers, but Light says the super PACs could join forces.
They may sit around the table and say, OK, you do the negative campaign in Ohio, and you do the glossy, happy advertising.
The candidates would scrounge for freebies, like volunteers. Nick Neihardt heads the advocacy group Public Campaign. He says the candidates couldn't afford to raise a big enough volunteer army.
I just don't think their shoulders would be enough to carry you on to victory.
So the candidates would have to shell out some money to travel and maybe run a few of their own ads. But it would be a short campaign. Paul Light estimates they'd burn through their $90 million in a week or two. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
On now to the Marketplace Ag Report. Agriculture is in the news, alfalfa in particular. It's a main food for dairy cows, and it's been growing faster than normal this year. So Wisconsin farmers are in something of a funk about when they should harvest this year to get the best quality crop and, by extension, get the best milk production. Yeah, it's the warm winter that's been messing with the food chain again. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
Some of us humans are lactose intolerant, but did it ever occur to you that cows have special dietary needs too? That's why farmers have to get alfalfa just right.
24 to 30 inches is the magic height.
Joe Spike is an agronomist with Landmark Dairy Co-op in Wisconsin. He's also an alfalfa farmer. He says if alfalfa is harvested too early, it won't have enough fiber. It'll pass right through the cow without the nutrients being absorbed. Now, the weirdly warm weather, which made alfalfa start growing early, has returned to normal. Cold, which is a problem.
When the leaves of the alfalfa freeze and die off, they fall off, so there's nothing really harvested.
Donald Vians teaches plant breeding at Cornell. He says this is the earliest alfalfa season he's seen in over 30 years, and the plant is having a tough time with the weather.
It's freezing it back just at the wrong stage for alfalfa to be able to recover very well.
So farmers are left wondering, harvest a poor crop early or risk letting it grow in erratic weather? I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, not so good. Not even not so good. Actually, bad is another word you might use. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A moment now for the 5 days gone by. 4 minutes of live radio in which we figure out what happened this week. It's a segment we call our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. This week we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also Catherine Rampell from the New York Times in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, so Lee, first of all, welcome back. How was book leave?
Oh, you know, never ask an author that.
Is the book done? It was productive. Is the book done yet?
That's what you should never ask. Oh. It's almost there. It's almost right there. Yeah. And I was productive and missed a lot of news on Wall Street, but got a lot done.
Well, and speaking of Wall Street, here we go. You ready? Banks today. JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, two of the biggest banks in the country, reported strong profits on, wait for it, good housing news, mortgage news.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, keep in mind, these are sort of the two model students where the banks are concerned.
Yeah.
They are the two that emerged probably the most unscathed from the financial crisis. But a number of things were interesting. I mean, it was, you know, on the good mortgage lending and also trading and investment banking were also up. And those are two specific divisions that have faced real headwinds this year. So,
right.
You know, it was good results for both of those two. And, you know, we'll see if it bodes well for next week when the rest of the banks and other companies report.
Catherine, Jamie Dimon said this morning, the CEO of JP Morgan Chase said, you know, housing looks like it's near a bottom. How does he know?
Oh, I've heard that so many times before. I remember being asked that, I think, 3 years ago about, oh, yes, we finally hit bottom. Look how far we've come down. We can't possibly go further. Nobody knows, to be honest. And it also sort of it depends on what you mean by a bottom. Are we at the true valuation of housing? That's also a very subjective thing. And in any case, probably you would expect the market to sort of overshoot.
Right.
Wherever that natural bottom might be.
Yeah. Picking up on the thing Lee said about trading and investment banking doing well as well, is that necessarily good for the common man, if you will, Catherine?
I'm sorry?
Well, so the question – so Lee picked up on trading and investment banking doing well for the big banks as well, right? Question is that good for the rest of us? Very nice for Wall Street. How about for the rest of us?
You know, the connection between Wall Street and the rest of us is a complicated one, right? To say the least.
Tenuous at best.
Yes. So I would say that to the extent that the financial system is healthy, that is certainly good for the United States writ large. But you, on the other hand, you don't want to encourage the banks to be taking the types of gigantic risks that they had been taking during the financial crisis that also endangered the financial system writ large.
All right. So let's go to Europe for a second, Lee, because I want to ask you about this whole European debt crisis, which, you know, disappeared from American front pages. Obviously, if you were in Europe, it was all over the place. But we seem to have forgotten about it. And now this week, Spain is in the news with borrowing troubles. I mean, Are we going back there again to that?
You know, we are. I mean, that's the thing. You know, I left 2 months ago. I'm back. You know, nothing has changed in Europe.
That's right.
And so that is exactly the same. And you're right. I mean, it's not in the headlines anymore, but that doesn't mean it's still supremely, supremely grave. I mean, it's, you know, all of the issues are still there and all of the problems are still there, and it's just going to continue. And it still remains the biggest threat to our recovery. So whether or not it's in the headlines is, you know, that's going to ebb and flow.
I'm not sure I would agree that what's going on in Europe is the biggest threat to our recovery.
All right.
So long
Explain.
As we don't
Compare
have...
and contrast.
Yes. So long as we don't have another financial Armageddon, I mean, that certainly would be terrible for
yes,
us.
But if they have
but,
one.
Right.
No,
but
I'm
if
sorry.
Falls
that's what
apart.
I mean. If Europe falls apart, if its financial system falls apart, that is one particular
right.
Terrible scenario that we don't want to deal with. It seems right now that a lot of the major banks are more insulated from a disorganized default from Greece or Spain or any of the others.
Right.
So that's
and,
less of a concern.
Right.
And our economy is not as dependent on Europe, per se, in terms of trade, as it is with other parts of the world like China.
Absolutely true. And just very quickly, Lee, one of the reasons we're insulated is because banks have had the time now to see this train wreck coming and prepare
Absolutely.
Themselves.
Yeah. They have. Right. But it doesn't mean that the global financial system can't kind of be shaken if right. something really bad happens over there.
Topic for another day. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a good weekend. Tricky in this age of cubicles and open office plans to be civil around the office. Hours of listening to a colleague's phone calls or dealing with them putting fish in the office microwave can be trying. No reason to be rude, though. Commentator Randall Kenneth Jones says professional courtesy has never been more important.
Like many of us, I was taught the golden rule as a child. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And when it comes down to it, professional courtesy is just as simple as using the golden rule at work. Do unto your coworkers as you would have them do unto you. But stop and ask yourself, how often does that happen in my office? Sure, it's easy to blame technology for the decline of professional courtesy. After all, hasn't our tweeting, posting, texting, and emailing taken away from our ability to, for example, talk to each other? But more than that, there's been a moral lapse in today's workplace in which treating business associates with courtesy and respect is no longer regarded as critically important. As we're all required to do more with less, have we simply run out of time for workplace pleasantries? At a time when displays of good manners seem to be on the decline in all parts of society, my biggest fear is, does anyone even notice anymore? When I was younger, not returning a phone call in any situation was unforgivable. Of course, that was before the majority of our work days were ruled by Outlook calendars, smartphones, and out-of-control email. The time earmarked for email management was once spent bonding with coworkers, becoming a stronger team by actually talking and listening to each other. More than please and thank you, professional courtesy has always been defined by the way we teach, learn, listen, and respond. The bottom line, if your team is lacking professional courtesy, it's probably also lacking the creative, analytical, and communication skills necessary to make your organization the best it can be.
Randall Kenneth Jones is the founder of the website rediscovercourtesy.org. Send us your thoughts, nicely please, through our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, charisma put to the test.
Actually, I have a fair idea of your charisma just from the split seconds that you've been walking in.
Just from the split seconds. All right, well, do tell. How did I do? Yeah, not so good. But first, let's do the numbers. On Wall Street today, a Friday the 13th to forget, the Dow Industrial slid 136 points, 1%, closed at 12,849. The NASDAQ gave back 44 points, 1.4%. finished at 3,011. The S&P 500 down 17 points, 1.25%, ended things at 1370. All three major indices lost ground for the second straight week. The Dow shed 1.6%, the NASDAQ off 2.2%, the S&P 500 and even 2% down on the week. China's slowing economy and fresh concerns about Spain spooked investors. Certain corporate developments hurt as well. You know that Google news we told you about, the stock split? Investors voted by issuing sell orders. Google shares dipped 4% today. Financial stocks took it on the chin, despite some encouraging signs of their economic revival, as we mentioned in the wrap. J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo lost more than 3% apiece. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues retail sales data for March. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And on April 16, 1862, President Lincoln signed the Compensated Emancipation Act, freeing slaves in the District of Columbia. It's a holiday there. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was big news in the publishing world this week that had nothing to do with books on shelves. The Department of Justice sued Apple and a handful of publishing houses for what the government said was price fixing for e-books. Downloadable novels and the like have been cutting into sales of old school hardcovers and paperbacks for a couple of years now. But all that technology may help save the printed page yet. Blake Farmer reports from WPLN in Nashville.
Next time you order a book online, consider this. Odds are increasing that the book itself hasn't been printed yet. Welcome to the world of on-demand printing, where books live electronically on a hard drive somewhere until someone wants a copy. On the factory floor of a company called Lightning Source in Laverne, Tennessee, rolls of paper 6 miles long zip through printers in a blur of gray. As a stream of freshly bound books trundles down a conveyor, it becomes clear what a potential game changer this is for the publishing industry. These are all single copies of different titles being printed one after another.
Storming the Tulips, Depth, Psychology, and A New Ethic, Massage During Pregnancy.
Larry Brewster helped start Lightning Source. Industry-wide, 1 billion more pages are being printed on demand every month, though there's still a tiny fraction of the 1.7 trillion pages printed last year. Online retailing and the rise of e-books have spurred the growth in on-demand printing. Amazon is one of the biggest customers for Lightning Source.
We actually show Amazon that we have 100 books on hand, but we really have none. We print the book real fast and ship it out within 24 hours, and they don't know the difference.
Such turnaround would be impossible with traditional offset printing, which uses presses and plates instead of inkjets. Initially, the knock against on-demand had been quality, but the technology is now reaching parity with offset printing.
There's a difference, but it's really hard to discern.
Bob Eddington is a vice president at Thomas Nelson, a publisher. The company's moving more of its books into the Lightning Source database. Printing one copy at a time does cost more, but Eddington says on-demand printing makes it possible to keep every book effectively in print.
With digital storage, there is infinite shelf space. So if it's available, it could be very obscure, but somebody will probably order it.
Lightning Source has a database of 9 million titles, 8 million of which are in the public domain. Every once in a while, the literary lottery hits and old books come back in vogue, like when TV pundit Glenn Beck talked up an obscure book of economic theory from the 1940s.
We're talking about Road to Serfdom. I don't know what happened to my copy. Here it is.
Beck's endorsement cleared the book off the shelves of the original publisher. Picking up the slack was Lightning Source, which is a division of Ingram Content Group. Ingram is a longtime book distributor. CEO Skip Pritchard says even now, as a printer, his aim is still to work with publishers and retailers, not compete with them.
We are trying to be neutral players to just help content reach its destination wherever it is.
But neutrality may go out the window as one of Pritchard's biggest clients, Amazon, becomes a competitor. The online retail behemoth has been inking deals with the Library of Congress and other national archives to scan and print books as needed. And in a written statement, Amazon said it's begun offering on-demand printing services to would-be self-published authors. Marco Boer is a consultant with IT Strategies.
It's causing a lot of uncomfortable conversations between publishers, between book printers, between retailers.
The more Amazon starts printing its own books, the less it'll need on-demand contractors like Lightning Source. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
I kind of got sandbagged by my producers the other day. Well, one of them, who shall remain nameless, but you know who you are. "There's this thing I want you to do," she said. "Just trust me." So I did. "Read this book," she said, "by a woman named Olivia Caban about how charisma and charm might apply in business. And then go over to the conference room. I'll meet you there." So I did. Here's how it went. Usually I'm the one who says welcome to the broadcast, but I'm sitting in your office now. I feel like I'm being tested.
You are absolutely right. And actually, I have a fair idea of your charisma just from the split seconds that you've been walking in.
All right. Well, do tell. How did I do?
You've got a strong presence.
All right. Well, good, because I consider myself fairly charismatic. Is it really something you can tell, like, right off the bat?
Yeah. And again, you're great on presence. However,
thank you again. Oh, no.
You're a confident man, right? You can take this.
Yes, I can.
Warmth. And this is...
Are you really... You're not going to tell me I'm not warm.
I'm going to tell you that I think you've been coasting on your good looks for far too long.
Oh, man. that's a little harsh. But anyway, what's the difference between charisma and charm?
Charm is purely to get people to like you.
Hmm.
Charisma makes you more influential and persuasive. Think Bill Gates.
See, now that's funny, because I've talked to him in an interview, actually, a couple of times, never in person, but he doesn't come across, at least on an audio line, as the most charismatic guy.
Indeed. But if you look at Bill Gates one-on-one in a room, he does get attention.
Huh. Well, it's because he's worth a bajillion dollars. I mean, come on.
You could say that, but apparently he's had that from the beginning. Visionary charisma is what Steve Jobs had.
I was just going to bring him up. Yeah.
He's not selling computers. He's saving the world.
This is funny. They're all men that we're talking about.
Oprah is, of course, your classic charismatic figure.
Here's another one. Hillary Clinton. What do you think?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a yes. That was a yes, kinda.
This is another example of lacking warmth.
Oh, yeah.
Clearly, intelligence.
I'm just like Hillary Clinton. Oh, my God.
Well.
All right, well, so now that I brought it back to me, how do I make myself warmer?
Do you want to is the first question. Because
of course I do. This is kind of my job, right? My job is to be a warm, welcoming presence on a public radio program.
You have kids, right?
Yes, I do.
How old? Oh, look at that change in your voice. How old is your youngest?
She's 4 and a half.
She's 4. And her name is?
Her name is Liv.
If Liv comes to you and she has bruised her knee.
Yeah.
And you tell her, it's all right, sweetie.
Yeah.
How would you say that?
Well, first of all, she's the fourth child, so she gets the, it's all right, here, you'll be fine. But so I guess the first thing you do is you pick her up, and you don't actually say anything. You say, shh, it's going to be all right, sweetie pie, I gotcha.
In the last three words when you said, I gotcha, that is what's called tenderness.
Yeah.
That's what you need. Show me love, Kai.
That's an entirely different kind of interview. We were talking about Steve Jobs and other corporate leaders, right, who are charismatic or have had charisma. Can they use that to commercial benefit for their company in terms of, you know, the Apple brand and you know, Alan Mulally at Ford, you know, those kinds of things?
Charisma is the X factor as our attention spans get shorter and shorter.
Right.
You have to make a big impression fast. So the good news is that now that we know that charisma can be taught, anyone can gain charisma.
All right. Well, since this is your interview, I'm going to let you say goodbye.
It was a pleasure to speak to you.
Thanks for coming by. Yeah, that was only slightly mortifying. Olivia Fox Caban is the author of the book, The Charisma Myth. You can go to our website to read an excerpt. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Here we are, Friday, about to wrap it up and go home. What better time to catch up on the news that didn't quite make the headlines? Comes to us courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Chow Tu, assistant web producer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So Barnes & Noble did this survey recently where they found that 42% of people
are annoyed because their partner is up reading with the light on. So this week, Barnes & Noble introduced their new version of the e-reader, the Nook, with a backlit light that won't disturb others.
Yeah, I'm sure that people were annoyed at the light, not the fact that their partner was reading 50 Shades of Grey and ignoring them.
Yeah, I don't think Barnes & Noble can fix that.
Rod Abid, senior producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Rico, I have in my hand from CareerCast.com the list of the best, worst, and most stressful jobs in this country.
All right, let me see here. Number one is lumberjack. that's the worst.
Yeah, software engineer is on the best jobs, along with things like dental hygienist.
Oh, look, what's at the number 10 worst job?
Why, that's you and me. It's the broadcaster. I think our job is pretty good, actually.
Number 7 most stressful job is public relations executive, with whom we have to deal with as broadcasters.
Maybe we create the stress for the public relations executive, and they make our job difficult.
Matt Berger, director of digital at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, there's this artist who's growing chairs.
Aren't all wooden chairs technically grown?
Technically, but this is actually made out of a living tree. So what the guy's done is he's created a wire mesh frame in which the tree grows, and when it's complete, you pull away the wire mesh and you're left with a chair.
So as a guy with an unkempt yard, this sounds like a great excuse.
Those aren't weeds. It's a coffee table.
That's my IKEA plan.
The radio show Brendan and Rico do is called The Dinner Party. There's a link to the podcast on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that's it for the radio show called Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gave back 136 points, about 1%. The NASDAQ off 44 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 down 17 points, 1.25%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, price discrimination at the dry cleaners.
The machines are designed to press men's shirts, and that the smaller size in women's shirts make them more difficult and more time consuming. But that doesn't really account for, you know, a large woman might have a shirt that's bigger than a small man.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.